Welcome. I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy who has a continuing interest in effective pharmacy leadership. The purpose of this conversation with a successful leader is to hear in his own words the key aspects of his career so that we can glean tips and lessons for ours. Remember, leadership is different than being an effective pharmacist. I would like to introduce Harold Godwin. By way of this brief introduction, he received his undergraduate pharmacy at the University of Kansas and his master's and residency at Ohio State. He's been a successful leader in both academia and in health system pharmacy. He was the director of pharmacy for a number of years. He's been chairman of pharmacy practice and is now associate dean at the University of Kansas Medical Center. Harold has also been very active in professional organizations. So, Harold, you previously have served on the ASHP Board of Directors and have been its president, and you're most recently elected and will become APHA's president. So, why spend all this personal time in professional organizations? Why devote that time?
Well, I guess I call myself kind of a pharmacy organizational junkie. I mean, it really goes back to, I think it's a part of the profession. If you're in a profession, it's different. And I remember being a member of, I guess, APHA when I was a student. And I maintained that. And then I went into residency in hospital pharmacy, so that's an ASHP member. And then I got into academia, that's an AACP member. So we have a lot of organizations in pharmacy. And I think that is the way I gain insight. But then also, perhaps, I can contribute, you know, from my experience. And so I've had a really rewarding career of being very, very involved. And for the new leaders out there, get involved. I mean, it's all the way from committees to volunteering for whatever. And then you kind of find yourself bubbling up, and you find yourself at bigger and bigger tables, if you will, and more responsibility. So it's really been rewarding to be a president in two major national organizations, and I think I'm still learning, still networking, and hopefully I'm still contributing for the sake of the profession. The profession's really been good to me.
What sort of skills do you develop as being president of an organization, do you think?
Well, I guess it is a focus on pharmacy issues, maybe unlike your job or your other career. And it's a matter of developing consensus, I think. I mean, at the board table, whether you're a board member or whether you're a committee member, you know, at an organization, or whether you're the president, I think that you're really trying to develop a consensus of thought. And you do that, obviously, by listening, but then by reflecting and by making suggestions. And hopefully the group comes to a certainly the group is going to come to a better decision than any one part of that group or individual on that group. And that's really rewarding, you know, to kind of see that. So I think you get a lot of that. Obviously, you're communicating a lot. And I think if you look at what are the traits of a leader, communication is high up on the list, both listening, and I do reflect that you have to listen, but also communicating both verbally and, you know, in the written word. So you have a lot of experience of that, I guess, dealing with, you know, state and national forums.
So what are the challenges facing APHA at this point in time, and what, as president, do you hope to achieve?
Well, a couple of things. One, I guess I've always looked, again, as a leader, trying to be a leader, at challenges, to me they're opportunities, not necessarily challenges. But we have, I think, two that I see. And first of all, it's first time in many, many, many decades, and that's healthcare reform. I think ASHP, many years ago, back in 1985, I think it was, the Hilton Head Conference, to which they really declared that pharmacy is a clinical profession. And that was really landmark. And I think we've seen the progress in health system practice and so forth over the years, and significant development in that area. But if you look at community practice, it's probably waned. I mean, we have some great models of late, but it's probably waned by comparison. So I think now with medication therapy management and the healthcare reform being reimbursed, that I think truly APHA American pharmacy, I will say, which is turning the corner on being recognized by the public as a healthcare provider, first of all, and also that it's a clinical profession. It's just not a place that you go to, you know, get a prescription or distribution. And I think that's also evidenced by disease state management programs that are happening, as well as immunizations. I think immunizations, that model is paramount, that really kicks it up a notch, if you will, from the standpoint of the public image and what we're able to do, because we're accessible, you know, we're there. So I would say this whole medication therapy management, healthcare reform, you know, is fundamental to what's happening today, and obviously I'll be involved with that, with the team, with the board of directors and with the leadership team at APHA. I think the other thing that we have started fairly well in healthcare reform has really been more collaboration and consensus among different pharmacy organizations. I mean, so often we've had, I'll call them silos or pillars, or, you know, we've communicated through JCPP, but, I mean, have we really had a cohesive action? And I think one of the things is we had 13 pharmacy organizations, if you can imagine that many, 13 pharmacy organizations sign on to what was called Principles of Healthcare Reform that stayed together all the way through this healthcare reform bill and so forth. So I think that's fundamental. And so when we think about lobbying on the Hill and we think about consensus papers and all of that, I think the coalition and consensus is really pivotal for American pharmacy. So those are two big things that I see that will be on my watch, I guess.
You've been president also of ACPE, the American Council on Pharmaceutical Education. Describe a little bit how it functions and what its role is.
Well, it started in the 30s, and it was a matter that we really needed some sort of standards or model for educating pharmacists. And so that a degree from wherever you got your pharmacy degree was essentially equivalent, it was going to be recognized by the boards. And it really was formed as a, I guess, a triumvirate. First of all, NABP as a piece of that action, because they're the licensee body, if you will, for state board and for a licensed pharmacist. And so ACPE appoints some members, you know, to that. The College of Educators, AACP, also appoints members to that. And then the pharmacy profession, practice, if you will, does the same. And so that's APHA. So there's kind of three. And then there's a public member. So it's appointed to this, you know, this panel. It's a six-year appointment. It's a lot of work. I was appointed by APHA back at that particular time. And the era was interesting, really interesting, because coming into that particular position, we had, I often say, it's a hodgepodge of pharmacy degrees. We had, of course, the BS in pharmacy. We had a one-year PharmD degree, a post-BS. We had a two-year. We even had a three-year. So we had all these different things that even used the same Doctor of Pharmacy degree, but they were all different equivalent. And at that time, we had two standards. We had a standard on the BS program. We had a standard on the PharmD program. Well, about my second board meeting, the question was raised, we need to change our standards. We need to, you know, revise our standards as we were. Why do we need to revise two? Why don't we just revise one standard? Well, it was probably a no-brainer to say, well, if we're going to revise one, why worry about the BS if we have the PharmD brewing? Why don't we revise the PharmD standard? And that's what we did. So we declared at that particular time that we're going to spend about a five-year process of studying this, developing standards, vet it, you know, with the whole profession, if you will. And that we declared that as early, this was in essentially 1990, that as early as 2000, we may convert to the all PharmD program. It worked, it happened, that's what we have today, and I'm really pleased to say that it was really rewarding to be a part of that. And essentially today we have one degree, you know, for the entry level degree for American pharmacy, and that's the PharmD degree. And now what we're finding is that all over the world, all the way from Asia to the Middle East to Europe and all of that, are essentially mimicking that concept of the PharmD. They're enamored with that. The other thing, of course, that it did was really bring in a significant, back to my term, clinical profession, a significant clinical component to, you know, to that degree. So I was really pleased to be there. I had kind of a rare moment in that I was actually appointed a second term consecutively on ACPE. So I really had 12 years in that. But it was a matter that, in APHA's wisdom, I think, to have a continuity from the inception of that degree to the implementation of that degree in all of our colleges. So it has done, you know, very, very well, sets a high standard, and I think it probably is a model for pharmacy education around the world.
So when either a new college comes online or a college is up for reaccreditation, how is that handled?
Well, most accreditations are on a six-year cycle, but obviously a new college, and we've had a lot of those with the pharmacist shortage. We've had a number of those new colleges develop. And so that there's some assurance that they are a legitimate educational unit, there's a lot of vetting, there's a lot of review and all of that. So, I mean, first of all, they have to guarantee that they have the financial wherewithal to put this together, that they have the faculty, they have a dean, they have a curriculum. And so there's visits after visits after visit, both by volunteer accrediting people that can go out, as well as the board. And so there's a lot of touch points, you know, and they go along until ultimately, hopefully, they are accredited and they're meeting the same standard as everyone else. The ACPE also, we're accredited, and we're accredited by actually the Department of Education, so which accredits medical schools and are the ones that review medical schools and you know, all sort of accrediting agencies in America, barbers, beauticians, and all of that, law schools. So, you know, we have our standards that we have to meet as well. And so, you know, we do that. One of the maybe criticisms of pharmacy at this point, do we have too many schools? Well, as an accrediting agent, we're really accrediting the standard and not how many schools. I mean, that's kind of the marketplace to determine that. So often ACPE is criticized, I guess, for can't you do something about all these number of schools? Well, we can assure that their standards, you know, meet the standard of the accrediting body, but, you know, we really can't control the numbers.
You grew up in a fairly small town in Kansas. What attracted you to pharmacy as a career?
That's a good question. That really goes back, I guess, to my roots, and that is that I was a sixth grader, and we had to write a paper, probably all of a page or two, but we had to write a paper about a community leader within my city, a population 1,600. So I went down and interviewed the local pharmacist, Hugo Cole, bless Hugo. And he spent a half a day with me, and I saw all those little bottles, and I saw all those apothecary jars, and I saw him, you know, doing compounding and mixing this up and all of that. And he let me behind that magic counter, you know, which nobody would ever be able to go. And so I was really enamored with that. And I this was fortuitous, I guess. You know, my whole career, I wanted to be a pharmacist. You know, I had no relatives, nothing. I wanted to be a pharmacist, even to the point that I thought, turned out I didn't need it, but I thought that I needed to take Latin in high school, so I took 2 years of Latin in high school because I was going to be a pharmacist and had to be able to read all those prescriptions. So anyway, I finished that. That was my declaration. I went to the University of Kansas in Lawrence, got my BS degree, you know, in pharmacy, and, you know, away I go. And then, you know, it's that point of what are you going to do from your own career? And then I was enamored with this new, I would say, specialty just being developed called hospital pharmacy. And then that's what, you know, prompted me to look at residency programs. Actually, they were called residency programs, but officially they were really internship programs. And it was a two-year internship with a master's degree. And so I selected Ohio State, and I've never looked back.
So what was the value of that residency master's degree, do you think, to you?
Oh, it's pivotal in a career. I am selling residencies all day long now to my students and to colleagues and residents. I think it really accelerates your career. Obviously, you graduate, you become a licensed pharmacist, you have the ability to practice in a lot of locations. but it really is a focus, toward a particular philosophy, I guess. And at that time, there were not very many residencies. I mean, today we hear PGY1, PGY2. We got, a thousand residencies programs out there. There really were not that many residency programs when I went to Ohio State. I looked at USC, actually, at a residency program. I looked at the University of Iowa. I looked at Ohio State. And I ended up choosing Ohio State. And a lot of it was because of my long-term, mentor now. But, I mean, at that time, I did not know him, Dr. Cliff Lachalet. And that was the magnet that attracted me there. And I have to say, I was infatuated. I was infected. I loved it. And I saw potential, I guess. And I saw that in that world, we were really focusing, I'd maybe say today, focusing on patient care, not dispensing this. I mean, it's the beginning, the very, very, very beginning. We didn't have unit dose. We didn't have IV admixtures. But I saw that potential because of the health system. I even tell my students today, why did this clinical revolution occur in the hospital environment versus maybe community environment or somewhere else? Well, one, you really were a team member, or you had the potential to be a team member. So you had physicians there, you had nurses there. The other thing is you had is a patient medical record. I mean, you had lab test value, you had all of that there. You had the whole package that you could really better use your pharmacology at that time. Now it's pharmacotherapy, but I mean, you could really use all those skills in one place. And so I saw that potential. I really got excited about that. And again, I never looked back. I finished my degree there and was fortunate to be asked to stay on as an assistant director in its beginning infancy, I guess, of developing programs at Ohio State. And so it's been a great career.
So talk a little bit more about the mentors or the people that have helped and influenced you. What did they do for you? And then we'll talk about how you now mentor folks.
Okay. That's a good question. And I would say to everybody, I would say to the veterans that are listening to this video later, reflect on your mentors, because I know you've had many. And I would say continue your own mentoring. But to the young leaders, that we're really talking to, find your mentor, reflect upon your mentor, thank your mentor, and I'll talk about that. You know, mentors are many different people. I mean, obviously the big mentor, I guess, is probably Cliff Lachalet, who was the director of pharmacy at Ohio State and, propelled me, I guess, in the whole area of my professional practice. But working my way through college in a cafeteria, I had a dietitian, Harriet Dyer, bless her, that was my boss. And I ended up somehow working my way up to be the head waiter, trying to control 50 students to get eggs out in the morning and deal with meals and punch tickets and all of that stuff. So, quote, I was the boss, even though I was like a sophomore in college, and Harriet Dyer was the manager. She taught me more about open door management, more about listening, reflecting, more about communications. And that was a fundamental. So I guess I'm saying mentors can be many different people. They can be a high school coach. They can be certainly your preceptor in pharmacy. But they're very special people. And I guess if you'd say, well, what's different about them? Well, one, they're non-judgmental. I mean, you have to have kind of a bond. I mean, can anybody be a mentor to any mentee? Yeah, maybe not. You've got to have a little chemistry there. But I think they're non-judgmental. They're trying to help. And it really does produce an open communication and listening. And that is so very, very valuable. And so you go through, you have mentors really all your life. So I've learned a lot from many, many, many people. And now you get to that kind of stage where it's payback time. And I think that is so very important. So that's why I really do enjoy teaching. I've had kind of a dual career here, because I can talk to the youth, and I still to this day mentor a lot of people in my residents that have come and gone and doing great things all over the country. I'm getting calls frequently. What about this? What about that? Because there's no judgment, and I think that is a big part of leadership, is finding somebody you're comfortable with, or several people you're comfortable with, and networking and using the mentor system.
How can an individual maximize that relationship with a mentor?
Well, seek them out, first of all. Be honest with them. Very famous person I know called Sarah White. I heard her speak at a meeting before students about 4 or 5 years ago, and about two or three years ago maybe. And she made the comment, Sarah, but you know, you did a great job on this, and said to these students, I challenge every one of you to have a mentor. Well, they may have had one, but they may not have realized that they had one. So I had one of those students come up to me and says, I'd like you to be my mentor, because Sarah says I've got to have a mentor. So I've been this gentleman's mentor now for 3 years, and he's in the residency program, master's program, but you know, he was just an undergraduate at that particular time. Lots of email, lots of phone calls. We're starting to raise a family. You really get into that. So, and again, don't maybe, I'm going to say this, but put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, that doesn't mean that you can't have other people that you really confide in and that you really help. Maybe a tangential thing is, I mean, mentors are one thing. Friends and networking could be another. What you really find in as you grow through your career are your colleagues. It's back to organizational work, and you can say, why do I? It's networking, networking, and networking. I mean, people are having the same issues that you are, whether they're professional or business or operational or whatever. And you may not call them mentors, but colleagues are so helpful to clearing your own head, giving you your own direction, or the comfort in, like, I thought I was the only one that had this problem, and I find out that, yeah, this is maybe something that other people are dealing with as well.
As I visit with young people around the country, they're often intimidated to come up and introduce themselves to you or I at meetings. Would you welcome that introduction?
Oh, always. I always do. I mean, it's kind of humbling. I mean, you know, and I'm open door policy. I would do that. I think one of the things that has kind of started, actually, in pharmacy and pharmacy residencies, I think, is that some residency programs are really assigning as a residency club, as a project, for the resident to go through, like, the Whitney book now on the web, and pick somebody that they would relate to and call them and interview them. Now, I'm sure that's intimidating, you know, as you said, for them to call up somebody they don't even know and said, can I set up an appointment to talk with you about your career and talk with you about, you know, issues and all of that. But that's happened, and I think that's a fantastic program, the residency programs that are really doing that, just to call up and, you know, pick their brain and get started. Because what I always do anyway, is say, okay, you finished your project, I want to meet you face to face at the mid-year. And so there, we almost have a special appointment to get down. And I have met some wonderful, you know, young people, and even carried on some later conversations, you know, with them because of that. So I would say that don't be intimidated, because I think a mark of a leader is somebody that will share. And to me, a mark of a leader is somebody that wants others to succeed as well. And so that's part of the payback for the career that you've had.
I look at it as a compliment that somebody would want to meet me. So
yeah,
yes,
sure.
Don't be intimidated at all.
Yeah.
What career planning advice do you have for the audience?
Well, I would say involvement and involvement and involvement. And I think that with that, your career will come. Now, that's pretty simple. But I have known people that I would say have set themselves up maybe for some disappointment, that have had a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan, a 20-year plan, or, you know, whatever, and they've scoped it all out. It doesn't quite happen that way. I mean, I think opportunities come up some of the strangest ways that they do. So I think you need a vision. You need a direction. You need to know what your comfort zone is. We may not have time to get into this, but I am a reader of management books and leadership books, and one of the ones that I really like are Strengths Finders. And it's kind of a self-assessment of kind of how you think, what your culture is, how you fit, and maybe how you relate to others and vice versa. So, I mean, I think you have to know yourself. And if you know yourself, that will help prepare you from a career standpoint. But I think you have to realize a career is multifaceted. And that is, obviously, we have a career in the profession. And so that would be organizational work, starting with the local chapter, state chapter, national chapter, volunteer for councils, committees, you know, whatever. I mean, so there's that. But, you know, there's a community, too. I mean, there's the community of the community center, the Parkinsonism Association, or the Alzheimer's group, or the soup kitchen, or you know, or the Lions Club, Rotary Club, whatever. I mean, that's a whole different venue, you know, that you have aside from, you know, from the profession itself. So I think a rewarding career is some that is very adaptable and really has, you know, a lot of different things. And it's satisfying. I mean, you want to be satisfied with the direction that you have yourself. So I guess I'm really concluding that you will find opportunities, trust me, you will find opportunities. Be prepared to take advantage of those opportunities. But if you think that you can orchestrate or really have a timetable for those opportunities to come up, that may not happen. So don't set yourself up for failure. I mean, take advantage of the opportunities. I've had many things that have accidentally, you know, kind of, it's how I got into teaching, actually, just a serendipity. I mean, I wasn't planning on being an educator, and I'm an educator.
Why don't you tell us that story? Because your career really has been a combined leadership in health system pharmacy and teaching in academia. Tell us the story about how you got involved in that, because it does follow nicely as the opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I'd finished my master's degree in residency with Cliff, and I was a brand new assistant director. It was in the summertime, starting at Ohio State. And the dean of the School of Pharmacy, a block away, calls up Cliff and says, you know, should have planned on this, but we got somebody in pharmaceutical chemistry that going on a sabbatical, and we don't have anybody to teach these courses. He says, yeah, one of any young bucks over there that will come over and teach a course. Well, I'm called into Cliff's office. How do you refuse the master, you know? He says, well, I want you to go teach these courses. And I said, well, what are they? And he says, well, the dispensing lab is one of them. And he says, the other one's an OTC course. Well, I was kind of in the hospital pharmacy world. I didn't know a whole lot about OTCs. I got pretty special in that. I teach an OTC course now, of all things. But Cliff says, now, this whole clinical thing was just starting, and Cliff says, you got to make that dispensing lab clinical. I'm going, oh, okay, clinical, dispensing lab. Well, before it was totally compounding, nothing but compounding. So I spent the whole, you know, summer literally handwriting out patient profiles with interactions in them and all of that, and so that each student would have a different set. And I got samples from the pharmaceutical industry so they could really count real pills. I mean, it wasn't compound. I mean, we converted the whole thing. We did patient counseling, you know, back then. So I worked very, very hard, had some great lab assistants that went on to really be great pharmacy educators. Actually, they were PhD students, and then they went on to Jean-Paul Gagnon, actually, was one of them. And so conducted the course. I got a lot of satisfaction out of that. The other thing is it really let me meet some really great people. And some of my students were Tim Webster, who is deceased, but former exec of ASCAP, Mary Alice Bennett, who will be following me as president of APHA, Mick Hunt, who's a, you know, a past APHA, you know, president. And so there were some, and Rosalie Seagraves, who's a dean at, you know, at Illinois. So those are some of my first students. And I don't know if they had an influence on it, but that was so rewarding to see that. So finished my job, it's over, faculty member comes back from the sabbatical and says, well, you've changed this course so much, I can't teach this stuff. So I continued. You know, I continued that, and it kind of really, I mean, we weren't doing MTM, but I mean, we were really, you know, kind of pushing the envelope from a clinical. So that was totally an opportunity. you know, that just fell out of the air. But I really enjoyed it. So when I interviewed at University of Kansas for director of pharmacy 3 years later, I said, I want a faculty appointment. And so I demanded that, got a faculty appointment, and, you know, went through the ranks, and, you know, I'm associate dean and professor, and still really engaged in that. And for a long, long time as director of pharmacy, I was, you know, really in both. As we'll find, many people, particularly in the hospital environment, are also, you know, preceptors and adjunct faculty, or maybe tenure track faculty, or whatever. And Sarah, you may not have mentioned, but, you know, you with me as associate director for 20 years at the University of Kansas, and a full professor. So you well know that many of us really had both appointments, you know, from an operations standpoint as well as faculty. And it was rewarding, and it was rewarding also to be engaged with the youth and the students. That maybe is what kind of keeps your mind young. But also, you're recruiting for residents. You're recruiting for the next generation and the next generation and all of that. And I still do that today. So. It kind of gets rewarding, it gets in your blood and all of that. So that was totally, it would not have been on my career development plan at all. I didn't even think of that. But it was an opportunity that presented itself. I took advantage of the opportunity, and it has been a very valuable career path.
So what were the pharmacy services and the education services like in 1970 when you went back to the University of Kansas?
Well, I would say I had seven pharmacists, including me, and about two storekeepers, and that was it. And it was not open 24 hours a day, and pills were being put in boxes, little slide boxes, with handwritten labels. So I'd come from the Mecca at that time, I guess, Ohio State, who really hadn't started, just begin IV admixture program, but really hadn't started unit dose at that time. But you ask the very first question, what's the value of residency training? I had a vision. But the difference is, I had the vision, but do you go in and now, and this is maybe an exercise for the youth here, do you just clone what you know? But you got a new environment. So you got to kind of assess and develop and so forth. So, huge hospital. Sure, I was director of pharmacy, but wow. I mean, it was so much work to do, you really had to assess to where you're at. So you start really looking at prioritizing, you know, where you're at. And so I thought, well, the first thing I'm going to do is go to 24-hour service. I mean, I thought, term I've often said, it's better to have lousy pharmacy service 24 hours a day than to have a, you know, great service 8 hours a day than have the nurse doing everything else, you know, after that. So we started propelling that. And then I felt, and most did about that era, that probably the most important unit dose product was an IV admixture, and so we started compounding IV admixtures, and then a unit dose program, and then we got into a clinical program. Now back to opportunities, and you probably kind of remember this, along the way, kind of a game plan, again, of opportunities, had to have people. I mean, we were growing the department, adding five pharmacists and seven pharmacists and all of that, a lot of growth, a lot of education and all that. But I remember getting a call from the director of nuclear medicine saying, hey, you know, I've been seeing something about this nuclear pharmacy thing. He says, that'd be a good idea. Where can I go buy one of these people? And I'm going, oh, wait a minute. I don't want you to go buying one. Why don't you let me buy one? Well, that was not on my game plan at all. That would have been about 19th in what service that I would have implemented at that time. But the opportunity existed, so you jump on it. So I said, well, why don't we develop that? I had a colleague within the medical community there, so we started a radiopharmacy service and never looked back, still have it. So so even though you assess, and that really was not a clone of Ohio State, a lot of parallels, so even though you are maybe cloning, but a good leader perhaps will also improve and improve that particular model. And that's what we really tried to do, and it, you know, it's really developed into a very, very comprehensive service.
So what's the key to getting support from administration, physicians, and nurses as one expands services?
Good question. First of all, you need somebody in administration that is understanding, and hopefully you need somebody that appreciates the clinical value of the pharmacist, not just the business, money value. I'll digress a second, but I've always said that I think the uniqueness of pharmacy is that we are both a clinical profession, but we're also a huge business, you know, particularly in the health system world. I always talk about my two-coat system. You know, I always had two coats in the back of my door. I had a white coat. P&T committee, I'm always in a white coat. Go to the floors in a white coat. You know, going meeting with nursing, I was in a white coat. But if I'm going to, you know, with administration, I'm going with the CFO, I'm in a suit coat. So I think it's a tremendous value of pharmacy that we play both, we're very well, we play both areas. So I've always been a coalition person. And so I think you really start out with a strong P&T committee, and you start out with relationships with nursing. And real simple things weren't then practiced, but I mean today, by today's standard. But a crazy thing like pharmacy nursing committee. I mean, just starting a pharmacy nursing committee, say, okay, what's the problem? So, you know, for the first year, you're just yelled at a lot, you know, but then after that, you say, well, we're going to try this, we're going to try. So you start to get them to buy into that. And so that's the way you really get support. The other thing I think is really the P&T committee. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, it's something you got to do. And no. That is a tremendous advocacy group, you know, that you can really have for your programs to show what the value of pharmacy can be. And, you know, one by one, I kept suggesting to the medical director of who to appoint to the P&T committee. And I wanted somebody that wasn't necessarily a yes person or a yes lady, that would challenge and really appreciate the intradisciplinary value of that. And so when you go to your administrator and say, well, the P&T committee recommends that we have clinical services, or the P&T committee recommends we do an admixture program, or they say we've got to have 24-hour service, that's pretty important and pretty impressive, you know, in order to sell that from an administrative standpoint. So I've really been very big on developing that advocacy as a part of your vision and your program, you know, in selling that.
Now, reading the political climate is also part of leadership. Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about developing clinical services at the University of Kansas Medical Center when there was a strong clinical pharmacology department.
That's interesting. We did have a very strong clinical pharmacology. There are not very many of those around now, but in a way, the clinical pharmacologist said there will never be a pharmacist at the bedside at the KU Med Center. He kind of told me that about day four, and this is going to be a terrific career. Because what they were doing is that medical people were in control and MD, and so therefore he could get a consult out of it. So he would have a consult from the docs, go up, make recommendations on things that we could do, kinetics and all of that, get a fee for that. Well, along the way, the political climate is they're saying, well, why should we be paying this person to do that when, you know, pharmacy could contribute to some of this. So we just kind of started, it wasn't a war we just started saying, okay, why don't we put one pharmacist up, two pharmacists, three pharmacists, you know, whatever, and the contributions really started to come. And without those contributions by the pharmacist, and you know, while perhaps the department or our leadership team, my leadership team, had the vision to do that, it was really those pharmacists that were well-trained initially, those pioneers, the pioneer clinical pharmacists, that really kind of made it happen because they were contributing. They weren't there to deal with drug distribution. Well, they could help with drug distribution. But the more they contributed, it just snowballed and snowballed and snowballed. I mean, you know, to the point it's 7 days a week, two shifts a day, all the time now. I mean, the emergency room and the, you know, everybody's, you know, we've come a long way in larger acute care hospitals, you know, in that regard. So political climate is very, very important. I think something, if we look at APHA and MTM versus the hospital, it's kind of the, you mentioned political climate or it's the economic climate, that in the early years of the hospital, if you provided more admixtures or, you know, whatever, and you charged more for it, that was good because that was income coming in. So you could really develop a lot of services because you were providing more products or whatever and services, and so you were reimbursed. Well, then when DRGs hit, you know, all of a sudden that was capped, and so then it was almost a negative incentive. And then what did hospital pharmacy do? Well, they figured out that we could say it's cost avoidance, it's medication safety. We took advantage of that political climate, that accreditation climate and so forth, to really say the value of pharmacists on the floor is preventing errors and misuse and adherence to formulary and all of that. So it worked. But you see how we had to really adapt significantly in that. That's the era that we're in now in healthcare reform with MTM. I think Congress, and I hope it proves well of the life of this video, that this conversation, that we, for the first time, will be being reimbursed, you know, for cognitive services in the community as well. And so that's that political climate really changing. The other thing is you line things up. If you really look at informatics, that's a big thing now in the healthcare reform area. Every patient in, you know, in America needs a personal medication record that they carry or that they have access to, because I think that's going to save a lot of money and it's going to provide a lot better care, whether you're going to the emergency room or your doctor or your pharmacist or whatever, that everybody's got a complete record. And I think that's really pivotal. And with that, it's like way back in our earlier conversation this morning, dealing with the value of why clinical happened in the hospital, because we had a chart. Well, just think of community practice has never really had the whole medical record. We're on the verge of being able to have that with health IT. And with that, you know, the reimbursement on MTM, so I'm very, very confident, I think, you know, that that political economic structure will change and will propel us as a clinical profession throughout the profession.
Did you establish the master's degree residency program at Kansas?
Yes, I did. There, fortunately, there was a professor that had had a, not a residency, but a master's degree in hospital that was on the faculty, so at least kind of knew what we were talking about, that had just got the MS degree approved in the university, but there were no students or anything like that. So when I came in, I said, ooh, well, what about a residency program associated with that? So the answer is yes. And so in 1970, we really started that. And again, never looked back. Our MS residency, you know, has continued to flourish. We need more of those. And I know, Sarah, in your writings, that you've repeatedly said, you know, we've got a leadership gap. And you know, we need... And part of this whole program is to entice people to get into leadership and all sort of different levels. But I have to say, there are more leadership formalized training programs, you know, that are really residencies and so forth that are really being developed. But Kansas now has an oncology residency and a DI residency and a whole many PGY1s as well. But the real heart of kind of our program too, yet for all these years, probably had about 125 now graduates. And they're leaders and directors and that all over the country, really, out of that program.
Harold, you've been a leader both in the hospital and in academia. Contrast if there are differences about functioning successfully in both of those environments.
Well, that's an interesting question because they really are two different worlds. But they're two different worlds that most people in practice leadership areas may focus, particularly if they are in a academic medical center, either as an adjunct faculty or as regular faculty that I think we previously talked a little bit about. But the focus, obviously, in the hospital is huge operations. When you have 100, 150, 200 people, and you have a budget to deal with, you have to deal with compliance from Joint Commission to State Board to DEA to, you know, all the other regulations, and program development and robotics and, you know, all the things that we really do there, plus deal with the financial aspect. Contrasting that over into the educational world, the academic world, you know, I have been a chair of pharmacy practice, so I had to deal really with budget and so forth, but that budget pales by comparison to what the hospital budget, you know, really is. And so the budget is mostly all people, you know, not drugs and so forth. So it's processes, it's education, it's compliance with the ACPE standards, et cetera. Pharmacy practice, I think, takes a significant burden, really, of the teaching responsibilities, pharmacotherapy, over-the-counter stuff, skills laboratories, and all the introductory practice experiences as well as the advanced practices experiences. And that takes a lot of time because these faculty, as you probably know, say, are on rounds, students are on rounds, I mean, they may be with a student 4, 5, 6 hours a day, so that's more arduous than just teaching a one-hour class 3 days a week or something like that. So that's the teaching component. Now, on the other hand, most faculty also have an expectation for research. And that research is defined maybe a little bit differently, generally the same, but maybe a little bit differently in a lot of different universities. And what that really means is scholarly activity, and scholarly activity is probably best judged by publications. And if you're doing publication on methods improvement or quality assurance, in you could even use in the hospital as your laboratory, you know, if you will, or basic clinical research. So that's an expectation, and then an expectation, you know, really to publish so that they get promoted from, you know, assistant professor to associate professor and so forth. So I guess my advice would be make sure you know what the expectations are for appropriate advancement, you know, in those settings. So
why don't you describe the difference between a tenure track faculty position and what's termed a clinical or adjunct faculty position?
Okay, adjunct faculty position is probably characterized, a little different definition by university, but generally, again, it's a similar process. Adjunct often is by virtue of your practice ability or whatever. So it's like a preceptor. So you really wouldn't be expected necessarily to publish or to have a research program. You're a full-time teacher, if you will, and so you're precepting students. Giving guest lectures in the classroom or so forth would be maybe an adjunct faculty. A clinical track faculty, on the other hand, is generally full-time faculty. And many times they'd have a modified title. It'd be called clinical assistant professor versus assistant professor. But there, they say, okay, you're like a regular faculty, but the expectation ratio is a little different. And that is that you do clinical practice, and perhaps your scholarly activity would be pharmacotherapy articles or review articles or of clinical nature. We want you to publish, though. We want you to show that, and if you get a grant, well, that's fine. But anyway, there's the expectations, again, of service, which you would be doing every day relative to your patient care services, maybe serving on some committees, teaching, but then heavy teaching load, but then scholarly activity, evidence of scholarly activity. Tenure track is a whole other thing in that they're really saying that after 7 years, if you've really not produced and advanced from assistant professor to associate professor, generally with tenure, you're out. You don't have a job. So there, teaching is important. Evaluations are important that you're a good teacher. But you really have to show scholarly activity. And that scholarly activity varies a little bit by institution. And again, in pharmacy practice, they don't have big research labs. They don't have technicians in the research labs. They don't have a bunch of PhD graduate students in the research labs to carry out a lot of that work. So, I mean, their scholarly activity is a little bit different. It's outcomes research, but they do need to publish, and that's important. And a lot of universities expect grant funding as well. Not to the level, certainly quite a lot in a way. So it kind of is, the adjunct is the least expectation from a research standpoint. The clinical track then is maybe not huge grants, but at least scholarly activity through publications. The tenure track really has all of those.
What do you think the success factors are for pharmacy leadership today and into the future?
The few studies that have been done in the pharmacy world really talk about communications, and I think that is so very important to be able to write and to speak and you know, to listen and communicate. And I think the way you achieve that is committees and guest lectures and just involvement. I mean, I would say just, you know, involvement, you know, in that area. The more involved you are, we talked about opportunities will come forth. Taking advantage of those opportunities. And I think that the real advantage for leadership in pharmacy, I think, is through students, and that's why I am in education as well, and I've been in practice, in a residency program, because in a way it's a transference. I mean, hopefully you have some vision. Maybe you have been able to see something that's invisible to others, and so you can kind of guide them in that way. But your success then is through their success. And that's what's so rewarding, I think, about teaching in residency and mentoring, is that you hope that you've influenced. I mean, leadership, probably the best word for it is influence. Mm-hmm. That you're influencing a committee, you're influencing someone, or you're influencing somebody else to go on and do even better and greater things. Again, as I talked about earlier at the table, I think if a collective decision or a consensus is always better than one dictator or one decision itself. It's always enhanced, and so I think that leadership for the future is really enhancing your mentees, if you will, or the people that you influence, and it could be many, and it could be at different levels. It could be pharmacists, it could be the community setting, it could be your church, you can be a leader in a lot of ways, but influencing them to the point that they influence others, and so that it really becomes a cascade.
So what about where hospital pharmacy departments are positioned within the organizational structure of a hospital? So should some of that change?
Yeah, that's a pivotal question. And my answer is yes. Pharmacy has come from a storeroom, stockroom environment. Even my own case at the University of Kansas with 7 pharmacists. But now we're very complex business. We're very complex clinical services. Still have the 2 coats, involved. The problem is that we often report to a VP or the chief nursing officer or somebody like that, that then has to translate our needs up the ladder to maybe an associate administrator or up the ladder to the CEO. And so we really find a lot of chief officers, chief informatics officer, chief nursing officer, chief financial officer. We need a chief pharmacy officer. And so I have been pushing for that in a few papers in the literature about really recommending a chief pharmacy officer. Not that it's a magic title that empowers you to everything, but you're at the right table. Because at the table there, you're making decisions on informatics for the whole hospital. You're making decisions on whether you're going to go to ambulatory care, what kind of care units you're really going to establish. There's all of these kind of decisions that are made at that table that the pharmacist must really be involved in. I call that the chief pharmacy officer, the CPO. So I think that is really pivotal. And so that, to me, is a huge goal from an organizational standpoint that health system pharmacy really ought to have. Again, it's not necessarily a magic title, but it's being in the position to use our influence at the best spot for greater gain of what we can do for patients.
In 1991, you received the Harvey A.K. Whitney Award, the highest recognition in health system pharmacy. Tell us about your message, and is it still current today?
Well, it was titled, New Beginning from Converging Paths, what I saw at that time, I guess I can almost say it's a little bit like deja vu here 10 years later, 15 years later, 20 years later. But it was that we had just started the steps to the All-PharmD. So we had 1 uniform degree, and I commented a lot about that. We had just kind of reactivated JCPP, so we really had a coalition of organizations thinking alike and together. In that, I also made a comment about we need community pharmacy residents. We do have about 75 community pharmacy residency programs now. So maybe some of those thoughts are kind of coming together. And I think with healthcare reform and medication therapy management and reimbursement for that and recognition of the pharmacist as a clinical role throughout, that it really is all coming together. So a lot of the hints that I made in that particular comment, and I was humbled to be able to achieve the Whitney Award, but it's refreshing in a way to go back and read it and say it's coming together. And now, for the youth that are watching, you've got your own past to go. and you've got your own trails to blaze. And I just hope that with this infrastructure, hopefully that we're going to have in the next few years, that you can even propel it to a greater profession.
Thank you very much, Harold, for your insights.